listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Voters chose Scott Brown yesterday, a little-known state senator, to fill the Massachusetts Senate seat that for almost half a century had been held by the late Edward M. Kennedy. With me today to discuss the upset and how it fits into the larger political picture is Douglas Schoen, who's been a Democratic Party advisor and political pollster for the past 30 years. Mr. Schoen's latest book, The Political Fix, looks at the problems he sees in the U.S. system of democracy and how they can be addressed. It's just out from Henry Holt. I'm very pleased that it brings him back to our show today.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Were you surprised by this Republican upset in Massachusetts, or had you seen it coming?
I think I saw it coming. With the amount of polling that was out there, I was clear that Brown was going to win and Coakley was going to lose. And to me, it represents a fairly wholesale rejection of the Obama agenda.
And why do you think that is? Perhaps some people have said, because Scott Brown really ran against the health care reform, some Massachusetts residents, it said, have fewer complaints about health care because of the state system, and they don't feel concerned about whether or not a national health care bill is enacted or not.
Well, I think the state system is also mixed in terms of its public reception, though I think it's fair to say in Massachusetts the federal legislation that the Democrats have proposed is more unpopular. And I think it was larger than health care. I think health care was an essential element, but it was big government. It was a sense of lack of control, the deficit, and a sense that Washington wasn't listening to the people.
Now, we had Joseph Stiglitz here the other day, and he and Paul Krugman might argue that the problem actually began when the president chose Larry Summers, Robert Rubin, and Tim Geithner to run the economy.
Well, Bob Rubin's not running this economy now.
But he has a say, and he's involved, and these other people are connected to him.
Well, Krugman and Stiglitz would argue for an even bigger stimulus, and I think some of the people who are angry in Massachusetts, to be fair, would probably agree with that and may well have voted for Scott Brown. I think a large part of what happens in politics is a rejection of the status quo.
But we can't say this is a referendum on decisions he's made about Iraq and Afghanistan because Scott Brown is a supporter of the war effort.
Oh, I'm not suggesting it has anything to do with Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm suggesting it has to do with a domestic agenda that hasn't necessarily succeeded and has left us with 10% unemployment.
What about the long, drawn-out process of coming up with health care legislation that will satisfy everyone? Might the president have been a bit firmer with some of the reluctant members of his own party, like Ben Nelson, or the Democrat who isn't, Joe Lieberman?
Oh, I certainly think that that's right. Bill Clinton made the mistake of doing health care in secret, and there was a sense in Congress that they'd been left out. President Obama basically said whatever Congress wants is fine by him. And by the hands-off attitude for 4 or 5 months, I think the president lost control of the process, and the results were clear yesterday.
Would you hazard a guess as to how much of an effect that lobbying by opponents of the health care legislation and other conservative causes has had on what happened in Massachusetts?
Well, I think it had a good impact, but I think that there is an innate fear in the American people of anything that's going to change the healthcare system, particularly if it involves new taxes and the expansion of the size of government. So I think that that gave impetus to the conservative cause.
And part of what Scott Brown was running on was that he'd be the 41st senator. Why has the 60-40 composition of the Senate become so significant? President Bush was able to push through a lot of legislation with a much slimmer Republican majority.
I think that what's happened is, first, the Republicans, unlike the Democrats, have been intransigent. That's number one. And
well, the Republicans say it all began when the Democrats went after Robert Bork.
I understand they say that, and we could spend all afternoon talking about when it started, but the fact of the matter is the Democrats, I think, have been more willing to engage in bipartisanship than the Republicans. That being said, I think that we have another problem which we have to point out, which is the divergence in opinion between the House Democrats and the Senate Democrats, and also between the House and Senate moderates and the House and Senate liberals.
In fact, some people have said that the Democrats did this to themselves because in their hope of getting a strong majority, they enlisted so many so-called blue dog Democrats to run, and now they're voting like blue dog Democrats.
Well, I think that that's true, and I think it's been impossible to bridge the divide between hardcore liberal Democrats and the so-called more moderate to conservative blue dogs.
And many of the reforms that you've suggested focus on reducing the role that partisanship has played in U.S. politics in recent years. Are you saying that it's at an all-time high? There's been serious outbreaks of partisanship throughout the history of the United States, hasn't there?
Well, I'm not saying it's at an all-time high. I'm saying it is certainly higher than it should be, and it's clearly destructive of our body politic.
Well, the president made much of working across party lines when he was running for president. Hasn't that backfired for him? He's having trouble working across the ideological lines in his own party.
He sure has, and I would argue that he would have done a better job bringing the Republicans to the White House, metaphorically locking the door, and saying, we're going to get a bill, and I'm not letting you out until we do that.
Do you think that even could have happened? Is that what Lyndon Johnson would have done?
I'm sure what Lyndon Johnson would have done, and it's absolutely what Bill Clinton did do with Newt Gingrich.
How would you make things more nonpartisan? You talk about creating panels of experts to deal with all sorts of issues.
Well, I recommend, for example, on the deficit, I think the idea of a bipartisan commission to propose legislation to reduce the deficit and reform entitlements would make sense, and also taking the attorney general out of the cabinet.
But wouldn't people be appointed along party lines, and it would just wind up being decided by whoever had the majority, and then the minority saying, well, you know, we really ultimately were voted out of it?
Well, I'd like to hope that that wouldn't happen. I can't, with one fell swoop, remove partisanship from people's souls or way of leading their lives, but I'd like to think some of the reforms I suggest in the political fix would be a step in the right direction.
My guest is Douglas E. Schoen, whose latest book is called The Political Fix, a title that can be taken any number of different ways. His subtitle is Changing the Game of American Democracy from the Grassroots to the White House, and the book is published by Henry Holt. In this book, you use particularly strong language when you discuss the way in which partisan politics has seeped into the judicial branch of government. You suggested removing the attorney general, as you said just now, from the president's cabinet. Why would that be effective?
Well, I would love to have an attorney general who was not subject to the appointment at the pleasure of the incumbent president, who had a term that didn't run coterminous with the president's term, and to have U.S. attorneys who similarly had a term of office that was not beholden to the political system.
Well, actually, it's become a less political office than it was in the past, wasn't it? The attorney general was often the president's best friend.
Well, I certainly think that that would not be encouraging. I think to go to the Bobby Kennedy model with John F. Kennedy would not be healthy. But I look at what happened in the Bush administration, and I don't see a healthy process.
What other organizations and special interests outside Washington, outside of Massachusetts, in addition to opponents of the health care legislation, got involved in this contest to support Mr. Brown? The Times reported today that he supports waterboarding as an interrogation technique and opposed a federal cap and trade program to reduce carbon emissions. Was that part of the campaign?
I don't think he was going around the state advocating waterboarding. He certainly, I believe, as I recollect, did oppose cap and trade. But there's one group you didn't mention, which is the Tea Party movement. And I think there was in Massachusetts and outside Massachusetts, a large-scale effort by the right wing of the Republican Party to bring in these activists to mobilize support, and by all accounts, it succeeded.
There's also been a fair amount of criticism of Martha Coakley as a campaigner.
Yeah, she wasn't a good candidate.
So what happens when you, as a political consultant, have a candidate who says things like, who makes fun of her opponent for shaking hands in the cold outside Fenway Park?
Well,
who doesn't know who Curt Schilling is?
I obviously saw that and heard that, and you try to avoid that happening. But that being said, given the size of the defeat, a 5% defeat in the bluest state in the nation, it's more than just bad campaign techniques.
The only state to go for McGovern.
Right. That's correct.
Did the Obama administration and the Democratic Party not fully understand the level of voter dissatisfaction?
I don't think they did. I honestly think they misjudged it, they minimized it, and they paid the price.
An op-ed piece for the Wall Street Journal's website last week reported that left-wing bloggers, at least, have been unwilling to accept polling figures that showed a decline in the public's support of President Obama. Instead, attacked Scott Rasmussen, the political pollster who provided the data.
Yeah, we're living now in a time that is hyper-divided, hyper-partisan, and hyper-polarized. Everything's fair game. Polls, PR, policy. I don't think we benefit from this kind of attack culture.
Well, but people feel very strongly about things. I know I feel very strongly about politics. And at a certain point, I have to blame somebody for screwing up.
But you are a man of civility and decency. And I would say that some of the people...
You don't know me well, do you?
I know you well enough to know that that is the case. And I know that many of the people on both the left and the right are not similarly endowed with your sense of fairness.
They will accuse people of all sorts of things. For a long time, we had people accusing the president not being born in the United States, despite a lot of evidence that suggested otherwise.
Well, that's it. I mean, enough. Stop it. You know, when people say, well, let's go back and blame Bush because it's his fault. You know, it may well be. But I guess the way I think is, look, we face urgent crises here. Healthcare, the economy, internationally. And we may differ. But if I'm blaming you and you're blaming me, one thing's for sure, we're not going to solve those problems.
As you point out in your book, political races often come down to money, and the best finance candidates usually win. You have had personal experience along those lines when you worked with our mayor. Do you have any idea of whether Mr. Brown or Ms. Coakley had the financial advantage in that race?
I think Scott Brown was raising over $1 million a day.
Because he was seen as the kind of savior for the conservative cause?
Precisely. And I think that made a huge difference as his poll numbers went up, his fundraising totals went up accordingly.
And I'm assuming a lot of that money came in from outside of Massachusetts.
Virtually certain it did, yes.
So a race like this, even though it's a local race, is really very much a national race.
Absolutely. This was a pure national referendum that happened to be held in Massachusetts.
I'm going to take a little break, and when we come back, we're going to go over some of the things that you talk about, some of the reforms that you propose in your book, because the book assesses the current state of democracy in the United States, and you suggest a long list of reforms. We won't be able to get to all of them, but let's try anyway.
We will.
My guest is Douglas E. Schoen, who has been a Democratic Party advisor for the past 30 years, a founding partner of Penn, Schoen, and Berland. He was President Bill Clinton's strategic consultant during the 1996 reelection campaign and has advised New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, former Indiana Governor Evan Bayh, and former British Prime Minister Tony Blair. This is his current book called The Political Fix, Changing the Game of American Democracy from the Grassroots to the White House. It's published by Henry Holt. We're back with Douglas E. Schoen. His book, The Political Fix, Changing the Game of American Democracy from the Grassroots to the White House, published by Henry Holt. And political fix in the past usually meant something different, didn't it?
Well, it meant in the past sort of wheeling and dealing. We mean here fixing a system that's hopefully not but could well be irretrievably broken.
Before we get to some of your suggestions, let's talk about some of the things that listeners have written in, although they do connect to things you're talking about. Derek in Manhattan asks why the size of the House of Representatives hasn't been expanded beyond 435 members since the 1910 census.
Well, it's a very good question. I mean, we need representative democracy. And if we had more districts and if there was nonpartisan redistricting so we had more competitive elections, I think that'd be good for democracy.
Well, we've been gerrymandering since the beginning, so can we expect any real change?
Well, states like Iowa have moved in the direction of nonpartisan commissions to do the reapportionment, so let's hope that we can.
Antonio in Park Slope asks, how about instant runoff voting? Ranking your choices 1, 2, 3, et cetera, is something that Lani Guinier suggested and wound up being called a quota queen for.
Well, I would suggest that the IRV system is very well worth exploring, and I think is something that in a number of municipalities has offered voters a broad choice and a wide range of options.
Another person, Harold, via Facebook, suggests that we have shorter campaign seasons.
You know, it's an interesting question. I mean, I, as a political consultant, I'll make a deep, dark confession. When you have a 10, 11, 12-month election, it's a pretty draining process. And on one hand, I think it makes sense to have shorter campaigns. On the other hand, if you have candidates going through a 10, 11-month process, you get to know them, their warts, their strengths, and better able to make a judgment. So it's a balancing process.
The shorter one actually would favor the well-known candidate.
It would, absolutely. You wouldn't have Barack Obama as president with a shorter campaign.
Don, via Facebook, suggests that finding a way to allow third-party candidates into debates would help break up party polarization and shift the emphasis toward ideas.
Well, I agree with Don. I've wrote a book about political independence, and I think I appeared on this program to talk about it, and I can only tell you that I agree wholeheartedly with that concept.
Now, several listeners have suggested something that you deal with a lot in this book, doing away with the Electoral College vote. This is something that has been proposed again and again ever since I can remember, and I don't think it's ever going to happen.
Well, there's a sort of Electoral College light system that's been proposed, where states would pass legislation that their electors would be apportioned as the national vote goes rather than the state vote goes. And that's a way we could probably move towards it, as has been done in the state of Maryland.
You've suggested eliminating the Commission on Presidential Debates with hopes of making the presidential debates more interesting and relevant, making Election Day a national holiday.
Why not?
Does that mean I won't be able to drink?
You can do whatever you like. You're free,
white. In the past, you could drink
over 21,
on
as they say metaphorically. But, you know, I joke about that. But what I would mean is we need to broaden participation of all groups and of all people and all interests. And Don suggested, you know, opening up the debates. The presidential debates are effectively a closed process. Election Day, why not have it a national holiday? Why shouldn't we have what we had in the Obama campaign happen every election? Broad participation, uninvolved groups brought in, and more representative democracy as the result.
Why hasn't campaign finance reform been more effective?
I don't think it's been as effective as it can be because we haven't found a way for challengers to get the resources necessary to challenge incumbents, number one. We haven't broken the stranglehold of party committees. And number three, we haven't gotten redistricting reform done in a way that creates fair contests.
You've proposed banning all political action committee contributions to congressional candidates.
Boy, you know, the PACs have such influence. They get together, they decide who they're going to support, and it really becomes a democratic system of and for the special interests. Don't think that's right.
But you, at the same time, suggested raising the cap on individual contributions to congressional candidates. If an individual, a multi-billionaire, gives money, how's that all that different than whether somebody is whether a PAC gives the money?
Well, there's a big difference. If an individual gives it, you may not like it. It is constitutionally protected speech. And one thing's for sure, he's not being influenced or she's not being influenced by a special interest, where if 50 PACs get together and give $5,000 each, the special interests are ruling the day.
Were you surprised at how few people turned out to vote in the 2008 election? After all, it was constantly being bruited about as a historic election. And we saw an awful lot of voters registering in the weeks leading up to the election, and then it was only slightly better than previous elections.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to say because it was slightly better than some previous elections. There were large numbers of young people who registered and may or may not have fully participated. At the very least, we didn't have a drop-off. We had a slight increase. That's a step in the right direction because, Leonard, this is about encouraging broad participation of disenfranchised and unrepresented groups, all minorities, all interests, and we really have to take steps to open up the process to all groups.
Don't many voters feel that their votes are fairly meaningless unless they happen to live in a swing state?
That's why we've got to get rid of the Electoral College, because if you have 15 states that make the difference, 35 or 36 states don't matter. And boy, that disenfranchises people. If everybody feels a stake, and you have candidates like Barack Obama running who really represent the American dream. I mean, you can disagree with him, as I might, but it's very hard to disagree with the notion of someone like him running for president in the way he did. That's uplifting. It's beneficial. We need more of it.
You've also proposed a number of reforms to the primary system, and we saw how complicated that was during the last election, especially for the Democrats.
Boy, it is complicated. I sort of say that Iowa and New Hampshire don't make sense. And, you know, it was interesting. I read Game Change over the weekend, and one of the laments of Hillary Clinton was this system is unfair because everything came down to Iowa. Barack Obama figured it out. She didn't. And he's president in large part as a result. I don't think that's right, even though the Obama campaign is historic and extraordinary.
So what would you get rid of? The caucuses?
I'd get rid of the caucuses, the superdelegates, and go to regional primaries so that you rotate. And
what
I just,
about winner take all?
I'm not a big fan of winner.
I can win a state by 2 votes, and I get all of its electoral votes, and somebody else wins a state by 2 million votes and gets all of that state's votes.
Don't think it makes sense. I mean, I just think that we need to move in the direction of being reflective of the people's will rather than more narrow.
Now, you also suggested eliminating judicial elections.
You know, I am somebody who likes democracy, I like elections. It's been good to me personally and professionally. But judicial elections have become special interest, bidding contests. And I just think that if we can have appointive processes, we will get a better judiciary.
You've also placed the blame for the current financial crisis squarely on the political system that we've been discussing. Because of deregulation?
Well, that's certainly a large part of it. I mean, I was not, in retrospect, for the repeal of Glass-Steagall. It hasn't worked. The financial interests, whether it be Fannie and Freddie or the big banks, whatever, have been able to run loose without any effective control.
Is that because of our partisan system?
Sure hasn't helped.
It's because you're saying ideology, perhaps.
I'm saying ideology has trumped practicality.
But hasn't that always, ideology's always been there in
well,
the political
process?
Well,
I will tell you, I'm perhaps not as old as you, but I'm long in the tooth.
Nobody's as old as me.
Well, I'm not sure of that, Methuselah. But that being said, I remember when I started in politics, there was a tradition of bipartisanship. After 5 o'clock, people would get together. You knew your colleagues. That's just changed.
How optimistic are you that any of these proposals will come into fruition in the future? I mean, we can't even get Congress to agree on whether there's such a thing as climate change.
Well, I guess what I would say is the following. If people like myself don't write about the problems we face and the need to change the system, we're never going to get reform.
My guest is Douglas E. Schoen, whose latest book is The Political Fix, Changing the Game of American Democracy from the Grassroots of the White House. It's published by Henry Holt. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You've said that in your Washington career, you've seen lots of people of goodwill on both sides who got sucked into a sick system and ended up doing things that never could have, they couldn't have contemplated doing before they entered the arena. Would the reforms you've suggested make it easier for politicians to maintain their integrity?
I'd like to think they would. I think the best part of politics is a system that is open to all, encourages participation from disenfranchised groups, particularly minorities, and gives people a chance for free expression. A narrow system where special interests rule and people have to sell out is really the worst form of political system.
Didn't your book have a more provocative subtitle at one point? A story in Publishers Weekly last year referred to your book as Political Fix, How the Electoral Casino and Perpetual Campaigning Have Broken American Democracy.
I think both are fair. I mean, I leave it to the publisher to pick the ultimate title, but that characterization is absolutely a fair and reasonable description of the way I see the system.
The Electoral Casino.
Yeah, it really is.
Do you, by the way, before you go, do you care to comment on the rumors that you're working on another possible presidential bid by Mayor Bloomberg?
Oh, sure. I mean, Mayor Bloomberg has made it very clear he's not running for president, not running for a fourth term. The only person I'm talking to, and it's just idle conversation because he's a friend, is Harold Ford Jr., who might well run for the Senate. But other than that, I've had no conversations with anyone about anything beyond that.
Well, okay, Harold Ford Jr., just one moment. Here's a man who took positions that many New Yorkers would find difficult to support. And then he comes here and he says, oh, well, I've changed my mind on all of those things.
Well, I think...
How do you, as a political consultant, deal with that?
Easy. I mean, if you take abortion, he's always been pro-choice. He said he's pro-life in a broader sense than on the choice issue. On gun control, he's always supported handgun control. Gillibrand was endorsed and had an A rating. He had, I think his best was about a C or C-plus rating, and he's for immigration reform. So I think he's got consistent positions that may well have changed over time. I think the incumbent has probably changed her positions more substantially than Mr. Ford. But we'll get to that if, and it's a big if, there's an election.
And just one more thing.
Please.
If the president would prefer to see one person run rather than another, should that be taken into consideration when a candidate is being chosen?
Gee, I really think in a democratic system, if the political elites were deciding who was going to run, Barack Obama probably would have been a less successful candidate than he was. I think that it's best for voters to decide, not political leaders.
If you were working for David Paterson right now, what advice would you give him?
I think the advice that I'd give him is what he's doing seems to be making sense, which is making tough decisions about cutting the budget and getting our fiscal house in order. It seems to be paying off in a marginally beneficial way in the polls, but undeniably, it's good government.
Douglas E. Schoen's book, The Political Fix, Changing the Game of American Democracy from the Grassroots to the White House, is published by Henry Holt. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Appreciate it.